It's Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica. Because I have no guest set up for my Yoga of War podcast this week, though I have two amazing guests next week, I am not sure if this is actually working. I'm going to just quickly check my YouTube, because when I look at my Chrome, it looks like this is not recording at all and that I am just a black screen. So hold on one second. Let's see. Not looking good, is it? Ah, there I am. Okay, sorry about that. I'll have to edit that out. In the meantime, thank you for tuning in. This is Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California. Just giving a little commentary this week for my Yoga of War podcast. I've had some incredible guests over the last month and a half, and I have some more incredible guests to come. Today, my guest is, no, not Benjamin, not Netanyahu. It's actually me. I'm just here today because I want to talk a bit about Netanyahu, about the uprisings in Israel against him, about what they mean and about what they implicate about him. So I do want to start with the question, is Benjamin Netanyahu truly evil? There's a lot of talk out there that would indicate that people believe he is, and I do want to explore that question today. Before I begin, let me just say, as all of you know, I am a yoga teacher. I live a yoga-based lifestyle, and let me just say flat out, I hate war. I hate war. I wish it didn't exist. I don't like guns. I don't even like toy guns. But I also know that realistically, war is a necessary evil. And especially when it comes between between good and evil. So I'm just going to be sort of going off the cuff today. Sorry if I go on some weird tangents. It's how I am. So today is September 12th. 2024. I feel compelled to talk because there have been hundreds of thousands, as it's reported, of Israelis who have been protesting in the streets of Tel Aviv, against Benjamin Netanyahu, and B, for a hostage deal. Now, let me just say that I, as much as anyone who doesn't actually have a family member who's being held in Gaza, because there's no way for me to compare what I feel about this to the distress and anguish of their actual family members. But I can say that since October 7th of 2023, there's hardly been a day when I have not been brought to tears, either by the sight or the memory of these hostages, what they have endured, what they continue to endure. What's so interesting to me and is so important for me to talk right now is that before 10/7, if you weren't like aware of what was going on in Israel, there were massive demonstrations going on throughout Israel against Bibi Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. Now, I'm not gonna get into that. All I wanna say is that Israel was a country deeply divided before 10/7. So deeply, in fact, that I had written a number of times on social media that this internal strife only gives license to the enemies that surround Israel from every single border to have the ability to come in and attack, because there was severe vulnerability, including people in the IDF and the reserves who were saying that they would not be serving because, again, of this judicial reform. Now, it's very interesting to note that, yes, my prediction came true. I only say this with a smile because I predicted it, but that, so Hamas took advantage of this vulnerability. As everybody knows, I don't have to get into it, on 10/7, there was horrific atrocities that were perpetrated by Hamas, and not just by Hamas, quite honestly, it was a lot of Gazan civilians who jumped in on the mayhem for the opportunity to massacre, rape, dismember, and kidnap Jews. Because that's fun. And the thought, the calculus was that Israel was a country so deeply divided at that moment that it would easily be toppled. That's not what happened. What happened was on 10/8, or even on 10/7, I say 10/8 to be dramatic because it's the day after 10/7. On 10/7, the state of Israel came together like there has never been unity before. A unity government was formed. A unity war cabinet was formed. All the reservists showed up at something like 150%, meaning not just everybody who was called up, but 50% more of the people who were called up showed up for duty. People flew in from all over the world. Israelis who were on vacation in Nepal, in America, in Spain, got their next ticket home so that they could defend their nation. Okay? So this is a really important thing to understand, is how the Jewish people, particularly the Jews in the state of Israel, really, really do come together when they need to defend their nation, and how integral it is to their very existence. So on 10/6, we had a nation deeply divided. Excuse me. On 10/7, we had a unity country, a unity government, and a unity war cabinet ready to face up to Hamas, to destroy Hamas, to secure the borders, and to ensure that all the hostages came home alive. So what changed? Critics are saying that, excuse me, I got something in my throat, that Netanyahu has been prolonging the war for his own personal gain and to maintain power in Israel. I think that there's no one, including Bibi, who believes that after this war, he's gonna have a job. That's true. There will definitely be a new prime minister after this war is over. So what I want to ask today is, we've got hundreds of thousands of people, not just all over the world, but now in Israel, who are marching and saying horrific things about Netanyahu. And my question is Netanyahu truly that evil? Is he truly willing to sacrifice the 101 hostages that are left in Gaza, keeping in mind that the current estimates are that approximately 40 of them, unfortunately, have already been murdered. So let's say about 60 live hostages, if estimates are right. Keep in mind, the Red Cross hasn't once visited these hostages, and everything that we know is by IDF intelligence, because we don't get any real information from Hamas, or, as they often call it, the Gaza Ministry of Health. So, Netanyahu, let's say 61-ish hostages' lives may lie in the balance, not to mention the soldiers, of course, who have lost their lives and continue to lose their lives in this ground battle in Gaza. Keep in mind that an air battle would have been a lot easier and safer to execute, and definitely would not have cost as many IDF lives. But Israel chose to go in on land in order to do very, very surgical attacks, in order to try to save not just the lives of the hostages, but quite frankly, the lives of Gazans. please check out my conversation with John Spencer if you want to understand more about the military morality of the IDF. I'm not going to get into that now because it's not really what I'm here to talk about today. So let me also state that no one seems to remember, like no one. I mean, Netanyahu doesn't even seem to remember. Why isn't anybody talking about the fact that on like day one or day two, Netanyahu did say this war was going to take at least a year, and he prognosticated into 2025, okay? So this is not new information. Oh, by the way, how long did the war on terror last that the U.S. had and our allies against like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc. after 9/11? 20 years, okay? So we're going on a year. We're going on a horrific year. And again, let me reiterate that I do not support war in general, but I do support war when it is necessary. Even the Bhagavad Gita says that we have a moral obligation to protect our nation and our family when they are in an existential threat. I also did a conversation about that in this podcast with Michelle Mazur that you may want to check out. Because war in and of itself is not immoral. It depends on what your intentions are. And I'll argue, everything in life depends on what your intentions are. Now, before I go on, I do want to say that these hundreds of thousands of people in Israel, I'm just going to talk about Israel, not like the world at large, who are marching A, against Netanyahu, and B, for a permanent, or let's say an immediate hostage release compromise. Okay, let's just say that a hostage deal that will release as many as possible. Let's say that, because I'm gonna get into that too, because the numbers, as far as I'm concerned, are sort of ridiculous. That this pressure is coming from families who are having a level of anguish and desperation that I'm not even gonna pretend that I can honestly and truly understand. I mean, that is beyond like the realm of human comprehension. I think that hopefully everyone, but definitely every Jew, every Israeli, at some point in the last 11 months, if not a lot of points, has sat back and said, if that were my mother, my grandfather, my daughter, my best friend in Gaza, what would I want to see? I mean, I can't even imagine, like I can't imagine. The oldest hostage is 86 years old, okay? Shlomo Mansour is 86. He was taken without his medications, without even his hearing aids. Like what does Hamas have to gain from holding an 86-year-old, as they call it, prisoner of war? Militant. This guy was a peace activist, just like almost every single person who is either massacred or kidnapped on 10/7, okay? These are not soldiers, but even if they were, the circumstances under which 10/7 occurred were barbaric. There is no words. And for the people who are related to these hostages, I could only imagine the sickness that must be within them all day, every day. I would imagine that they've barely slept or eaten or functioned in 11 months, because I know that I barely have, and I don't know anyone directly there, and I live across the world, nice and safe, in Los Angeles, California. So I don't want to impose my own morality on these people who are marching, because I do understand their anguish and their grief and their terror and their prayers that their loved ones can come home safely. I hope that all good and moral people on both sides would like to see these innocent hostages come home. But when it comes to a deal, a hostage deal, and whether Netanyahu is deliberately stalling negotiations, or perhaps there's something apolitical and more strategic about his decisions, this is a question we need to ask ourselves. Because let's look at the deal on the table and what they're really demanding. Keeping in mind that Netanyahu has actually formally accepted every deal as proposed by the United States of America, even though I will definitely argue none of them was favorable to Israel. So currently, the deal that's on the table, right, is a minimum of a 6-week ceasefire, okay, and withdrawal from Gaza. Now, when I say a minimum of 6 weeks, this gets a little bit complicated, because in stage two, there's this weird stipulation that if they don't come to a deal on stage two, that the negotiations and ceasefire will continue indefinitely until they do, which is so weird, because it really makes this indefinite ceasefire incredibly indefinite, okay? So who gains from the ceasefire? Does Israel gain from actually ceasing fire, or is it Hamas, the terrorists who started this war? If I come up to you and punch you in the nose, I punch you hard, I break your nose, and then you pummel me to the ground, who's at fault? I started it. I can't cry that you pummeled me to the ground when I came up and broke your nose, okay? That's not fair play, but okay. Let's move on. So the first part is a complete ceasefire for a minimum of 6 weeks. Second part, and this is a big bone of contention, and probably the biggest for Israel, is there is some disagreement on whether Israel should abandon the Philadelphia Corridor. Now, if you're not familiar with the Philadelphia Corridor, it is the border in between Gaza, Rafah, and Egypt, okay? Right now, Israel has control over the Gazan side of the border, okay? Egypt has control over the Egyptian side of the border. Now, Egypt is actually claiming that Israel taking control of the Gaza side of the border is some sort of that they were breaking the treaty that they had, the terms of the treaty that they had with Egypt, which is absolutely ridiculous. Because if you want to talk about the treaty that they have with Egypt, let's talk about the more than 150 tunnels that Hamas has built from Egypt to Rafah. Now, what are those tunnels for? Well, first of all, it's how Hamas gets most of their munitions. They are smuggled in with a wink and a nod from Egypt. So if we want to talk about breaking treaties, let's start there. Also, there's been a lot of fear that even Sinwar, but even if not Sinwar, maybe Sinwar is still in Gaza and doing his thing, but that some hostages may have been smuggled through these tunnels into Egypt, where they could be taken to places like Iran, say, Okay? This is like a tremendous danger. The IDF is trying so hard to locate these hostages. And if they're smuggled out through the Philadelphia corridor, then what? Okay? So there's that. It's going to be very hard to just abandon that corridor unless we could get some sort of international body, not the UN, by the way, okay? The UN has already proven UNRWA is so deeply embedded in Hamas, you can't even separate the two. But if we have a coalition, an international coalition, that is willing and able to secure the border between Gaza and Egypt in a way that ensures that tunnels will not be built again, and munitions will not be smuggled in again, and hostages will not be smuggled out, then and only then will Israel be able to leave safely the Philadelphia corridor. I know that there are people high up in the military who are saying, actually, we can leave the Philadelphia corridor for a few weeks and then just come right back in. And it's not that simple. It's not that simple. Why did it take Israel 3 months to get into Rafah, where they knew the hostages were being hidden and where they knew there were quite a few battalions of Hamas militants? Because of U.S. pressure and international pressure. So if Israel withdraws, okay, for 6 weeks, how easy do you think it's going to be for them to just be like, okay, war again, time for war, okay? It's not that simple. It's not that simple, like I'm going to go in and out of my apartment or my garage. We're talking about the IDF. And today there's news that the Rafah battalions have been dismantled. But this is a game of whack-a-mole. And every time that Hamas is destroyed in one area, they pop up literally tunnels in another area. So at what point do we know that these borders are secure? I mean, I don't know, but let us move on, shall we? Other terms of the agreement. Now, yesterday there was a new proposal from Israel. An interesting proposal because I almost feel like at this point, the whole negotiations have become sort of a joke to both sides, because yesterday Israel offered safe passage for Sinwar and his family out of Gaza, most likely to Qatar, where harbor all of the other Hamas billionaire leaders, okay? That Israel will guarantee Sinwar and his family safe passage out of the country, to wherever, probably Doha, and in exchange for all 101 hostages. Okay? Here's the problem. Hamas will never give up all 101 hostages because they are their bargaining chips. So even though this is in ways a very interesting offer, it's also pretty much a non-starter for psychotic terrorists who actually feed on the blood of hostages. Okay, the hostages. The actual deal that's on the table, okay, stage one is to release up to, okay, we don't know what this number is, excuse me, up to 30 Israeli hostages, okay? Now, Hamas has not indicated who these 30 hostages will be, nor have they indicated whether they are alive or dead. We do know now that Hirsch and Carmel, two of the hostages who were brutally murdered It was really not even 2 weeks ago, but it feels like 2 years ago now. It's just been such a painful and overwhelming time. Apparently those two at least were on this list of up to 30. So let's say now up to 28, okay? Remember that the common thought is that there are maybe 60-61 hostages who are still alive. Okay, so we're talking about Hamas releasing dead or alive up to 30 of the 101 dead and alive hostages, okay? Now, I have been poring over these negotiations and reading them over and over and over. What is starkly missing and tragically missing, and maybe it's an oversight, but I've literally read reports from dozens of sources at this point, and I cannot find a single reference in any of them that Kfir and Ariel Bibas are going to be among the people released. Let that sink in. In stage one that's being negotiated for up to around 30 hostages, baby Kfir, who's just over 1 year old, and his brother Ariel, who's just over 5, are not among the hostages that are being negotiated for in this first round of the deal. What are these people on the streets marching for? What do you think is going to happen? Let's say we get out 30. And I'm willing to bet anything that a lot of those will come back in body bags. But let's say we get 30 hostages back. What do you think is going to be the fate of the other 71 that include Kfir and Ariel? Okay? I understand, again, how badly these people on the streets want to see their family members come home. What do you do when you are marching by the hundreds of thousands to get your family members home and it turns out they're not among the select 30 and the other 71 are basically, all the pundits believe, going to be condemned to a certain death? So then what? Because in my opinion, unless all 100 hostages come home, and sadly we do know about 40 of them at least have already been killed, but unless all 101 come home, I don't know that this deal is going to really satisfy anyone. Now, let me mention one more aspect of the deal that is ridiculous, untenable, unfair, and just completely immoral. And that is the concept that we are going to be once again swapping innocent hostages, okay? Grandfathers, older women, children, if the children get released. And by the way, there is no sin in being a man or even a young man. We all cried for Hirsch. He should have been released. Not because of Netanyahu. Hamas should have let this young man go. I'm not here to say that one life is more valuable than another, because one of the values that we uphold as Jews and as the Jewish nation of Israel is that all lives matter. Okay? Now, I do want to emphasize for anybody who's throwing up red flags and saying, what do you mean all lives matter? What about all of the Gazan lives? Don't they matter? Yes, they actually do. They actually do. In truth be told, if you listen to the spokespeople from Israel, from the IDF, from the Prime Minister's office, from COGAT, you'll see that all of them mourn the death toll of Gazan civilians. But there's never been a war without civilian casualties. Never, never. These ridiculous standards that Israel is expected to be held up to, that no other nation on earth in the history of warfare has ever been held up to, they're ridiculous. They're unfair. But ultimately, no one wants to see death. No one wants to see death of civilians in Gaza. And nobody, I'm talking about Israel, I'm talking about Netanyahu, wants to see death of the hostages or of more Israeli civilians. So what Hamas wants is for Israel to release from prison. The number keeps changing, but it looks like right now they've negotiated down to approximately 150 Hamas prisoners, many, many of them actual murderers, in exchange for each hostage. So just keep in mind, like, an incredibly dangerous precedent was set when Israel decided to release 1,027 prisoners in exchange for one soldier, Gilad Shalit. Why? Because in the Torah, in Jewish morality, we believe that every life represents an entire universe, and there was no price too high to get this soldier home. Yes, among that 1,027 was your favorite guy, Yahya Sinwar, which, by the way, or whom I should say, was actually healed of cancer by Israeli doctors while he was in prison, only to go home and be the mastermind of 10-7. Let's keep that in mind. Now, ultimately, releasing 1,027 prisoners for one soldier kept hostage set a very dangerous precedent, because it tells Israel's enemies, we really, really value our citizens' lives. And we're willing to negotiate even with terrorists, even at ridiculous prices, to get our hostages home. I think we learned our lesson. And this is a very, very hard lesson, because it's an impossible calculus. How many lives will be lost if we continue to fight, and how many will be lost if we capitulate? Because the people in the streets are asking Netanyahu to capitulate, and they are accusing him of, again, manipulating the system and abusing his power in order to extend this war and maintain his prime ministership. Okay, let's play this one out. If Netanyahu goes along with this deal, Hamas stays in power, okay? Now, I know there are a lot of people who say, okay, fine, I don't care. Let's just get the hostages home. They've been there for almost a year. I can't imagine what they're going through. They need to be taken home. They need to be healed. They need to have proper burials, as the case may be. They need to be taken care of, and they just need to be saved. I get that. I really, really get that. But you have to understand that Sinwar has said, and Hamas has said over and over and publicly, that given the chance, they will commit the atrocities of 10/7 again and again and again. Here's something that I hope Jews have learned over centuries, millennia of persecution. When your enemy says that they intend to kill you, believe them. So if Bibi, if Netanyahu does in fact decide, okay, I'm gonna take a deal at all costs. I'm gonna let Sinwar and Hamas stay in power. We're gonna get up to 30 hostages home, knowing that the other 70 will surely be murdered. And I'll just do what everyone wants. Then what? One more 10/7, we get another 1,000 people massacred, two more, three more. Whose fault is that gonna be? Oh, Netanyahu's. They're gonna blame Netanyahu if Netanyahu makes the decision to surrender to Hamas, allow them to stay in power, to regroup, and to create more massacres and atrocities. So, is Netanyahu evil? Is he really acting out of politics? Or is he trying to figure out how to secure a nation with enemies at every single border? It's not that simple. The pressure that the world, in particularly, again, I'm sorry, I want to focus on the Israelis, are putting on Netanyahu right now, that pressure is, it's unfair, it's deeply misguided, and quite frankly, it's precisely what Sinwar wants. He's actually said that publicly. He has actually told, like, the press, that his goal, his strategy, is to first get the world to turn on Israel, which he's done very effectively, and then to get Israel to turn on itself. And quite frankly, and I say this with a complete and utter love for Israel and its people and my people, it astounds me sometimes how the Israelis are simultaneously the most brilliant, intelligent, and innovative, and totally stupid and self-destructive nation. It makes no sense to me. It makes no sense to me how Israelis, no matter what side of the aisle they are, no matter what they even think of Bibi, whether they like him, whether they hate him, the thought of putting all of the pressure on the Israeli government instead of on Hamas, to me is just crazy. It's Netanyahu derangement syndrome. We see it in America, not against Netanyahu, against Trump. And I'm not saying this as a political statement. I'm a registered independent. I am neither Democratic nor Republican. I'm not here to endorse any single candidate. But when I see the level of Trump derangement syndrome in this country, it's impossible not to draw the parallels to what is going on in Israel. Between the media that turns against him, the lawfare, exactly what they're doing here with Trump, turning the voters against him, all of the stuff, okay? Again, let's take the politics out of this, but the derangement is really, really real. Because I don't believe that people are thinking straight anymore. And I don't blame them. Most days, I don't think I'm thinking straight anymore. The world has gotten so crazy, so Orwellian. I feel like I am living in an inversion of a universe that I thought I used to know or belong to. So I get the derangement, but I think we need to all see it for what it is. Listen, there's no irony in the fact that Hamas has executed the single most effective propaganda campaign since the Nazis. Ironically, both campaigns against the Jews. Now, when it comes to these demonstrations in these streets of Israel, just like there's a lot of talk in America right now about the dangers of a pending civil war. I question that because I understand the sentiment, but like, what are the sides? Okay, that's a really hard one to define. And so they're saying the same thing in Israel, that they are precipitously close to a civil war. Now, the way that I see it, I don't really see it as a civil war so much as a coup. Which is sort of remarkable to behold because Israel is actually a democratic state. And while simultaneously this group of people is trying to overthrow the government, the democratically elected government, they're actually proving the very democratic nature of Israel itself. Now, let me just go on a tangent because I love tangents. I was in Israel when the judicial demonstrations were going on. And here's what I saw that was so interesting and so different from the demonstrations that happen in the streets of America. When Israelis demonstrate, and you can see it on any of the videos as well that are going on now. When Israelis demonstrate, they actually wave Israeli flags. Okay? Process that. They're demonstrating against the government and they are waving Israeli flags. What do people do when they demonstrate in America? They burn the American flag. There's a fundamental difference here. Here's the thing. When Israelis demonstrate, they demonstrate because they have such a deep, visceral, and fundamental love for their country on an absolute soul level, and they just want to see their nation thrive. I walked through the demonstrations in Tel Aviv. It's people singing and hugging. And you know what happens at the end of the demonstration? They ride home on their bicycles with their flags and go back to their friends and family who may or may not be on the same side of the argument as they are because they don't care. They all love their country. And that's what it comes down to. In America, people demonstrate because they hate America and they hate Western values. When I was in Israel two times ago in April, I was talking to some people about how in America, for the most part, the American flag and the Pledge of Allegiance and patriotism have become symbols of the right, of the Republicans. In that they're literally, in many instances, looked at with disdain from the left, from the Democrats, that the flag now represents colonialism and racism and all the things. And my Israeli friends literally could not comprehend this concept of a national flag representing anything other than the entire nation. No matter what they believe, no matter what political party they belong to. So this is some important context to understand about Israel in general. They are what we like to think of in America as one nation under God. They understand that, but sometimes they become their own worst enemy. Here's the thing. Israel, as far as I'm concerned, and in America, there's just so much rhetoric about our democracy being threatened. And a lot of people saying, oh, you know, Israel is a dictatorship or this and that, because Netanyahu's been in power more or less, not the whole time, for about 18 years. But it's not because he's a dictator. It's because Israel is, if anything, in my estimation, too democratic. Okay? If you are not familiar with the system of government in Israel, let me explain it a little bit, because I do believe that what actually needs to be overhauled is the whole structure of the government. So the way, in a very simplified version, the way governments are formed in Israel is you don't vote for a person, a prime minister. And by the way, there is a president also, but he's largely a figurehead in Israel. It's the prime minister who holds the power. Now, you don't vote for the prime minister. In this case, if you don't know, the prime minister, the current prime minister of Israel, is Benjamin Netanyahu. He's not a president, he's a prime minister. So when people go to the polls, and FYI, everybody in Israel, including the 20% Arab population, has equal voting rights. Okay, I'm gonna get to that point in a minute because it actually becomes relevant. But when you go to the polls, you don't vote for the person, you vote for the party, okay? So Netanyahu's party is what's called Likud, okay? I don't wanna get too into the fact that every poll that I have seen ever since the war still has Likud getting the most votes of any party. Okay, there's that. Now, once the votes come in, the party with the most votes gets what's called a mandate to form a government. Now, in order to form a government, they need to form a coalition of all these different groups. Okay, you have to get like 61 seats. And so let's say the blue and white party, the religious party, the Democrat party, you have to go to each of these little parties that also got votes and see if you can form a coalition, okay? That would be like if we took the Republicans, the Democrats, the Green, the Libertarians, the Independent, the No Labels, I don't know, we don't have many parties in America, and each one got a certain percentage of the votes, and then you tried to put them together to come up to 61, okay? Now, as you may have heard, there were like 5 or 6 failed governments in just a very short series of years, because as far as I'm concerned, this system has become untenable for the same reason that in America, I'll call it social media, that we're so polarized. The left is so far left, the right is so far right, and there's no one left in the middle. So how do you form a coalition of little tiny parties all over the map? It becomes very, very difficult. And in fact, when we had the Bennett-Lapid government, so it was really Bennett and then the government dissolved and Lapid took over for sort of the interim until the next government was formed, which went back to Bibi, they actually had to form a coalition by inviting in the Ram party, okay, which is the Arab party, okay? Now, I don't have a problem. In fact, I have the opposite of a problem with Arabs being represented in the government. They should be. They're 20% of the country. But here's the problem, okay? Ram, for all intents and purposes, is actually an anti-Zionist party. So Bennett, who I think is an amazing person, had to actually invite anti-Zionists into the party in order to form a coalition government. Now, his government really did span from like the left-left to the right-right, and I guess it was no big surprise that 1 year later, the whole thing collapsed, and it went back to elections. And Bibi was able to take the mandate and form a coalition. Now, if he couldn't do it, then the next party would have the opportunity to try, and it's just really difficult. So here's a question that I really want to put forth, especially to anybody who actually does believe that Bibi needs to be removed. Who else in Israel today can actually form a viable coalition government? Now, I've posited this to a lot of my friends who are pretty deep into the political structure of Israel and who oppose Netanyahu, and they do not have an answer. Why? Because most likely there is no one else right now who could form a coalition. Now, Likud being still the most popular party in Israel, there is the chance that they could choose a different leader, such as Saar, whose name has been, you know, bandied about, that maybe Likud does form a coalition, but with a different prime minister. That is definitely a viable option, but again, who is gonna stand behind him? Who are those people? And keep in mind that Benjamin Netanyahu has relationships with all the world leaders. Good, bad, or ugly, he has the relationships. And he also happens to be the prime minister that put Israel on the map basically as like a tiny superpower. The startup nation, right? They have the third most companies on the NASDAQ, and they only have, what is it, like 11 million people in the whole country. So they're behind Israel and China, and then there's, behind America and China, and then there's Israel. Thank you, Bibi. Now here's the peculiar conundrum about Benjamin Netanyahu. To the left, he is considered to be too far right. To the right, he's actually considered to be too far left. And ironically, no one considers him a centrist. Okay, can you see how crazy that is? And how unsustainable this reality is? Because if no matter what you do, you're always going to upset 50 to 100% of the people, then what do you do? Who's going to do a better job? And then the next question is, what are the implications of A, going to elections, and B, changing government mid-war? Israel is currently in an existential war, literally for its very existence and survival. Could you imagine having to change governments and coalitions at this time? I mean, think about it. We're even just now, like our nation in America is thinking about how the whole nation, like the whole fabric, is going to fray with the next election, regardless of who wins, because how do you make that dramatic transition from Biden, who I'll say is pretty centrist, to Harris, who is quite left, or Donald Trump, who is quite right? Now imagine doing that in the middle of a war, okay? Because if the commander-in-chief is not allowed to chief, and somebody else has to come in and take over those reins, like, where's the continuity? How do you save your nation? I actually do agree there need to be elections right after this war, but I think that having them during the war is a really and truly frightening prospect. Now, let me get to like the real crux of the matter. Everybody is putting so much pressure on BB to give more, to negotiate in better faith. America, like, literally keeps throwing this political football where they're like, the ball is in Hamas's court. And then the next day they're like, BB isn't doing enough. Which one is it? Which one is it? Because it can't be both, and it's not. And you can't actually negotiate with terrorists. In fact, you shouldn't negotiate with terrorists because it gives them legitimacy. And they are not legitimate. They are not a legitimate government, and they are not a legitimate negotiation partner. We are trying to negotiate rationally with bloodthirsty, genocidal, suicidal psychopaths. This is not on Bibi's intransigence. Okay? Once again, he has actually agreed to multiple offers by the United States, including the most recent bridging proposal, to very unfavorable proposals in order to create a ceasefire and get as many hostages as we can home. And each time that he agrees, Hamas turns the screws and adds some new and utterly ridiculous demand that they know Israel will not be able to agree to because it will be signing their own death certificate. This is not on Bibi. This is on Hamas. And I understand not how, but why the world is drunk on the Kool-Aid of the Hamas propaganda that so deliciously, once again, gets to vilify Jews. Jews, yes, let's kill the Jews. They're the reason. They're the problem. They're the reason that we had to behead babies and burn families as they were tied together and drag grandfathers over as hostages and rape the women and then throw grenades into their vajayjays, so that they can actually be booby-trapped if an IDF soldier should come and try to save this body. Yes, the Jews deserved this. They have always deserved this. Hitler was right, right? Because that's what the people in the streets are marching for right now. Intifada is not a call for peace, my friend. Intifada is a call to murder all Jews wherever you can find them. This is our negotiation partner. Please, how do we turn a Netanyahu, a legitimate and democratically elected leader, in favor of Sinwar? A murderer who is the mastermind of all of these atrocities. Netanyahu is not evil, my friends. Netanyahu has the hardest job in the entire world. Why? Because Israel values life while Hamas values death. This isn't rhetoric. This isn't rhetoric. Hamas says straight out that the more innocent civilians who die in Gaza, the more they win the world's sympathies, the more the world turns against Israel, the more they win. And they do. Just today, the UN decided that Palestine gets to have an actual and full seat in the Security Council. Okay, you might think, so what? Because they're saying it's because they, quote unquote, actually I'm not quoting this, I'm paraphrasing, meet all the qualifications of an actual state. Okay, please name for me another state on the planet country that has no government and no borders. That's okay, I'll wait. So this is what the UN thought would be an appropriate reward for 10/7, because that's exactly what it is. So the same reason that the demonstrators in Israel, that hundreds of thousands of people are flooding in the streets, which is because they value life so desperately, is the same exact reason why it is impossible for Netanyahu to negotiate with Hamas. You can't negotiate for life when you're negotiating partner, I call it a partner because they are not negotiating in good faith, is negotiating for death. Ultimately, Hamas started this war. They started it on purpose with the most barbaric massacre and terrorist rampage that we have seen in modern history. Anybody who's marching against Netanyahu right now, within Israel or outside of Israel, there's really no difference between them and the people who are actually marching for Hamas. I know this is going to be an unpopular statement. I support Benjamin Netanyahu, and I wish him all the prayers and all the blessings in the world that this war should end in a way where Israel accomplishes its goals of securing its borders, of destroying Hamas, but most of all, of getting all, each and every one of the 101 innocent hostages that are being held in the most inhumane and horrific conditions in Gaza home. Bring them home now.